Welcome back, friends, to episode 73 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available exclusively via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. The Nats GM Show is sponsored by our friends at NoHalftime.com and the No Halftime app. So, what is No Halftime, you ask? Well, let me fill you in a little bit, guys. You're staring at your weekly fantasy opponent and thinking to yourself, I would love to challenge just one of his players, not his entire team. But your fantasy sports service doesn't allow you to. Now you can on the all-new No Halftime app. The No Halftime app allows you to create individual challenges using players or teams. For example, you can pit Bryce Harper versus Mike Trout, Miguel Cabrera versus Manny Machado, or Chris Davis versus Matt Kemp. Creating a challenge takes seconds, and accepting challenges is even easier. No Halftime challenges can be private or public and created for the MLB, NFL, NBA, NHL, PGA, and other sports. Join today and get started. Real money and fantasy supremacy awaits you. And now you can also try No Halftime for free with $0 challenges. Visit NoHalftime.com for more information and to download the No Halftime app for your iPhone or Android device. Receive a bonus by entering in the promo code NATSGM at signup. Receive a free t-shirt when you make a deposit. No Halftime, where the fantasy sports season never takes a break.
This is Matt from MattsBats.com, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
Proud to welcome this week's guest, Professor Emeritus of Physics at the University of Illinois, a physics of baseball researcher, and the man behind the website, The Physics of Baseball, Dr. Alan Nathan. Alan, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Looking forward to talking with you.
Well, as I said to you off air, I'm a huge fan of your work. I've seen you at Sabre Seminar a few times, and you were on one of those bucket lists of guests that I wanted to get on the show at some point. So I'm very honored and privileged that I got you on the show today.
Pleasure is all mine.
Well, thank you so much. The first place that I want to start this week, and the big topic I want to talk to you about, is the knuckleball. It's always been just fascinating to me that this pitch that, you know, can flutter, and, you know, we see guys with high end velocity, and yet these guys with the knuckleball can make people look just silly. And I kind of wanted to start kind of with just the you know, generic question of, you know, when somebody's throwing a knuckleball, like, what is happening, you know, from a physics point of view and kind of that perspective?
Yeah, sure. The I would say the physics is maybe not as well understood as it should be, the sort of in the sense that it's very hard to be predictive with it. It's hard to somehow predict what's going to happen with the knuckleball. But the underlying physics, I think, is fairly well understood. So most pitches are thrown with spin, with a lot of spin. And the movement of those pitches is determined partly by gravity, everything falls, and partly by how rapidly it's spinning and what the spin axis is. With a knuckleball, it's totally, totally different. The knuckleball is thrown with very, very little spin. And the movement on a knuckleball, of course, gravity still affects it, but the movement over and above what you get from just gravity has to do with the air flowing over the seams of the ball. The seams are absolutely crucial to how a knuckleball works. And we know about this from people who do experiments in wind tunnels and things like that. You know, the same kind of experiments that they do on, you know, airplane wings and automobiles, you know, things like that. You can study baseball aerodynamics that way. And when you do that, you discover that the air exerts a force on the ball which causes it to move, but that movement, the size and the direction of that movement, is very sensitive to how those seams are oriented relative to the motion of the ball or relative to the air flowing over the ball. So the idea of a knuckleball is to throw it with very, very little spins. If it were spinning rapidly, the direction of the force due to the seams is would be constantly changing as the ball rotates, and the ball couldn't keep up with whatever direction of those with the rapidly changing direction of those forces. So it contributes no net effect. So the real key to throwing a knuckleball is to throw it with very little, almost no spin. Typically, maybe between release and home plate, maybe no more than, say, about a revolution or so, roughly speaking, a revolution. You know, maybe preferably even something like half to three quarters of a revolution. And that could produce some effects that are pretty hard to actually predict by anybody, the pitcher, the batter, the catcher, the umpire. And that sort of is a sort of a brief summary of the underlying physics behind it. It's the changing of the character of the airflow as it flows over the seams.
Now, the thing that we always kind of are taught is, or you hear the knuckleballs dancing, and you hear that term, but from what I kind of have gathered from past interviews of you and so forth, is it really doesn't flutter. It more just has like one or two little, you know, kind of movements to it.
Yeah. What you say, I've actually talked about before. So way back when Pitch FX first came out, Pitch FX, as your listeners probably know, is the system of cameras installed in the ballparks that's tracking the trajectory of the pitches. So way back in the early days of Pitch FX, I actually got the idea that, you know, it would be fun to look at the actual trajectory of a knuckleball and compare it with normal pitches to answer exactly that question that you pose. Is it really dancing? So a few years ago, I did that. So maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when R.A. Dickey was pitching for the Mets and Tim Wakefield was still pitching for the Red Sox, I think it was the 2011 season, but I might be wrong. I might be remembering incorrectly there, but it was around either 2011 or 2012. I managed to get a hold of the so-called raw tracking data from Pitch FX for four different games, two from Wakefield, two from Dickey. And I decided to look at that raw tracking data to really ask that try to address exactly that question. If I compare the knuckleball to other pitches thrown during those games, do they look different? And the answer is they really don't look all that different. The trajectory of the knuckleball to the extent that you can measure it accurately. So the Pitch FX cameras are measuring an image of where the ball is every 1/60th of a second. And it's measuring it with a precision of maybe a half an inch or so. So within that half an inch precision, so you can sort of say there's an unknown half an inch that we can't account for because it's not within the precision of the instrument you're using to measure it. Within that half an inch precision, knuckleballs, most of the knuckleballs look pretty much like regular pitches. They look smooth, meaning in technical language, you can more or less fit them to a constant acceleration, which is what Pitch FX actually does. And that was a bit of a surprise to me. It seemed not to agree with everyone's intuition about what's going on or perception about what's going on. So that led me in a new direction. The direction being, okay, why is it that perception seems to be at odds with reality? And that gets into be sort of an interesting thing in and of itself. So the perception is that the knuckleball is just literally dancing all around.
Exactly.
And the reality is that it doesn't really, when you look at the data, the data don't support that view. Now, what is true about the knuckleball is that the movement is unpredictable. Now, to explain that, I have to back up a little bit. If you look at any pitcher throwing virtually any pitch in Major League Baseball, and you look at the movement on that pitch, the four-seam fastball moves in a certain way. The two-seam fastball moves in a certain way. Slider, cutter, curveball, changeup. They all move in a pattern that you can basically predict. If you know that pitch is coming, then you can predict how that ball is going to move. What's different about the knuckleball is that it seems to move in a completely random direction. Sometimes it goes left, sometimes it goes right, up, down, and anywhere in between. And you look at the PitchFX data on the movement, and that immediately just jumps right out at you. So, and then you start thinking about, think about what the catcher is trying to do. The catcher, obviously, poor Ryan Hannigan for the Red Sox, you know, he's having a heck of a time of it catching Stephen Wright this year. And you can appreciate why. When he calls a pitch, you know, a fastball, a curveball, a slider, he knows what that pitch is going to do. And so he knows how to position himself in order to catch that pitch. With a knuckleball, he hasn't the faintest idea about where it's going to break. So he doesn't know how he should position himself and what that pitch is going to do. And think about what happens when a catcher calls a certain pitch and they get their signals crossed up. The catcher, you see the catcher diving at the last minute, lunging for the ball. Sometimes it's a pass ball. He's totally clueless because the pitcher is throwing something that he didn't expect. That is essentially what the knuckleball is, because nobody knows what to expect from it. It never seems to do the same thing twice. So my guess is that the perception of dancing is really just lack of knowledge as to which way that pitch is going to break. And that the data do seem to support that sort of notion.
Now, do the pitchers in the way they grip the ball and the way they throw it and everything else, do they kind of have some effect over the way the ball moves? And can they control is not the right word, but can they have some idea of where it's going? I mean, can they get that good?
I can't give you a hard, crisp answer to that, but I think the answer is yes. And that gets into all kinds of things, such as why there aren't more knuckleball pitches. Because I think the reason why there aren't more knuckleball pitches, one of the reasons is that it's very difficult to control the pitch, and it takes lots and lots of practice to get the feel for the pitch so that you know it's going to break in a random way, okay, almost regardless of what you do, how you try to release it. That's almost inevitable. But you need to keep that movement within some bounds so it has at least some chance of entering, you know, near the strike zone. And so keeping it within those bounds, I think, is what's really difficult and why there are so few – one of the reasons why I think there are so few knuckleball pitches. If you read some of the things that R.A. Dickey has written or talked about, it really took him a long time before he gained some mastery over that pitch.
So is this something that if we wanted to see more knuckleballers in the major leagues, we should be teaching it to kids at a younger age? Or do you think this is just such a specialized skill within the game that it's, you know, the real outlier are the types that can really control it and throw it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So let me answer it this way. Back in, was it 2012 or when Dickey was the Cy Young winner in the National League back when he was the Mets? He had two great years in a row, 2011, 2012, I think were the years. In 2012, he was Cy Young winner. And people were asking exactly the question you're asking back then. And there was even, they even set up this knuckleball academy that was going to do what you suggested. Start teaching kids at a young age how to throw, how to control that knuckleball. And that kept, you know, that whole interest in developing knuckleball pitchers went on for a year or 2 years, and then it sort of fizzled out. And, you know, here we are, and people seem to have lost interest in it again. So I personally think that there should be an effort to try to teach people how to throw a knuckleball at a young age. You know, there is some stigma attached to knuckleball pitchers, okay? Knuckleball pitchers are almost all of them failed regular pitchers.
True.
Regular pitchers who failed at that, and they switched to the knuckleball as a way to save their career. Tim Wakefield is a bit of an exception. He's a failed first baseman. But other exceptions, of course. I think Hoyt Wilhelm and Charlie Huff, I think, maybe threw knuckleballs even early in their career. But Dickey is a prime example of a guy who really was not very good as a regular pitcher and learned how to throw the knuckleball, devoted a lot of effort to perfecting it, and in effect saved his career as a result. So I don't know if there is a real acceptance of knuckleball pitches within the major league community. It almost seems as though there's not.
And that is that's a good point that I hadn't thought of. That's a good point. The stigma attached to it definitely is a negative. I think we're all coming off reading The Arm recently or hearing about, you know, the Jeff Passan's book, and that would seem like one way to logically try to decrease the number of arm injuries that we're seeing with pitchers. The epidemic that we're seeing is if these guys were throwing a more controlled pitch at a lower speed. Maybe that doesn't cure the problem, but it certainly might go a long way to try to help it.
Oh yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think among other things, knuckleball pitchers are innings eaters. You know, they typically pitch deep into a ball game, save your bullpen, and certainly there's a case with Wright this year. It was the case with Dickey when he was pitching for the Mets, and you know, lots of times since, of course. I think there's lots of good reasons for trying to get more knuckleball pitchers into the game. As a side issue, I think there needs to be more of an effort to train knuckleball catchers because it really does take a special skill to be able to do that. And it must be an exhausting experience catching a knuckleball pitcher in a game because you can never seem to relax.
Yeah, you've got to be on edge.
As I said, poor Ryan Hannigan has been having a tough time of it this year. He's been persevering, but you could see that he's simply not comfortable back there. But there are catchers who have been comfortable. So back in the day, Tim Wakefield had Doug Mirabelli as his private catcher, and it worked very, very well. Mirabelli, somehow they figured each other out. Mirabelli just somehow figured out how to keep soft hands and keep his body loose enough so that he could maneuver at the last minute if necessary in order to catch the pitch. But as I said, I think along with training knuckleball pitchers, I think developing knuckleball catches is another important thing. One thing you don't want to have in your roster is if you've got one knuckleball pitcher on your roster, it seems you don't want to use up a roster spot with a catcher whose sole job it is to catch that pitcher and nothing else, which is sort of what Mirabelli was for the Red Sox. And it's a tough way to keep a roster spot.
Yeah, I'll never forget.
If that's your only contribution.
I'll never forget when they had to give him the police escort to get to the game to catch Wakefield when he was traded for. That was great.
He didn't even have his jock strap on.
That's dangerous, catching a knuckleballer, too.
And that's dangerous, correct.
Another question I have is how does the climate and where the pitcher is throwing a knuckleball affect how it moves or the movement of the pitch?
Yeah, I would say that's a question that hasn't been carefully studied, but I could sort of give you some just rough ground rules about it. Almost all aerodynamic effects, drag, movement, things like that, are directly related, directly proportional to the air density. So whenever the air density is high, you'll probably get more movement. Whenever it's low, you'll get less movement. And so what can make it high and what can make it low? Well, high elevation, such as Coors Field, is low air density. You won't get as much movement. Maybe that means it's easier to control, actually. I don't know. But anyway, I don't know if anyone's investigated that. Generally speaking, high temperature has lower air density than low temperature. So you could predict that in cold weather, the knuckleball is going to move more than in warm weather. Humid air is less dense than dry air. so the ball will move less in humid weather. But there's another important effect of humidity, which is the ability of the pitcher to properly grip the ball. So there was a game a couple of weeks ago or so when Stephen Wright pitched a horrible game. I think it's the worst game he's pitched all year. I think it was in Texas, and it was hot, humid weather. And the high humidity affected the movement of the pitch. But I think even more importantly, it affected his ability to grip the ball. He just didn't have the feel for the ball in that humid weather that he normally would have. And I think that hindered his ability to throw the knuckleball very well.
That's an interesting point, because now I'm just kind of thinking off the top of my head, and it seems like so many of the knuckleballers in the last 35 years or what have you have all been in the Northeast. You got Dickey with the Mets and Toronto. You got Wakefield and Wright with Boston, and several others I'm missing, but Charlie Huff and the White Sox and all those. It seems like maybe for that reason that they've kind of clustered.
Maybe. It's interesting to speculate about it.
I mean, it's completely small sample size, obviously, but it's just quick theory anyways. So I guess the last question I have for you about the knuckleball is just what's going to spur us to see more of them on major league rosters? Is it the development of the catchers, as you mentioned? Is it a breakthrough with the TrackMan and this PitchFX? I mean, what could bolster this?
Well, I think what would bolster it is success. So when Dickey had success, there was a lot of talk about this. Now that Wright is having some measure of success, if he can keep that up through a whole season, maybe into next season, my guess is you'll start hearing more discussion about the same thing. So I think what will get the ball moving, so to speak, on developing knuckleball pitches is seeing at the major league level that pitchers are actually having success doing it. And, you know, look, major league clubs, they're not stupid. If they see something is working very well, they're going to start buying into it. That's what I think.
That's a great point. If I can move topics, although you were touching on it in your last answer, I was telling you off air that I was watching the Nationals and the Mets game last evening, and it was a humid night. It's been humid in the Northeast the last week anyways, and the ball was just flying out of the park. I mean, things that looked like relative pop flies were getting out of there, and I had a couple of baseball fans sitting with me, and they're like, why does the ball carry so much better, and why do we see so many more home runs when it's really heavy, thick, just awful air? And I just, from the physics perspective, I'd love to understand why.
Okay, so there is this misconception that when it's hot and humid that the air is heavy. And people think that the air is heavy because since it's so humid, the perspiration is just dripping off your face. It's not evaporating from your body like it does in dry climate. So one thinks that the air is really heavy. In fact, it's not heavy, it's light. So high temperature reduces the air density. And contrary to what oftentimes people think, high humidity produces less dense air, not more dense air. So the ball carries better. And there's a very simple reason why that is. It's because a water molecule it weighs less than an air molecule or a nitrogen or oxygen molecule. That is just that simple. So humid air is actually less dense than dry air. So a ball will actually carry better in humid air than in dry air, because there's less air density means less air resistance. By the way, it's not a huge effect. Okay, it's a relatively small effect, but it goes in the opposite direction that people think it goes, or oftentimes think it goes.
How small is the difference? Because goodness, it seems like, and you know, we see it at all kinds of parks. The Wrigley Field comes to mind as well. When it gets hot, the ball just jumps. What is the actual effect? I mean, not to the exact number.
Well,
obviously, I'm not trying to put you on the spot there. But
yeah, the humidity effect, I don't remember. It really is a small effect, though. It's small enough that it's almost not worth worrying about. The what is in effect, though, is the temperature. And I have, you know, roughly speaking, a 10 degree for, you know, for a ball that's sort of on a typical home run trajectory. So we're talking, you know, it leaves the bat at, you know, a bit over 100 miles an hour at, you know, somewhere between a 25 and 30 degree launch angle, which is sort of what's optimum for a long fly ball if you're trying to hit a home run. What I found just from analysis of the StatCast data is that 10 degree change in temperature is worth about another, I think it's 3.5 feet. Let's see, I have it here, 3.3 feet for a 10 degree increase in temperature. So even that's not a huge effect, but you know, if it's a, you see it most easily by, you see it most easily by comparing, you know, cold days in the spring to hot days in the summer, where you might have, you know, you could imagine having a 50 degree swing in temperature between those two extremes, you know, say 40 degrees to 90 degrees.
Sure.
Well, you know, that's if 10 degrees gives you 3 and a quarter or so feet, you know, 50 degrees is going to be more like 15, 16 feet or so. And that's huge. I mean, that's the difference between a warning track fly ball and a home run. So it could make a big difference. But I think it's hard to see those differences, you know. You ask what's the difference between 90 degrees and 80 degrees. Well, it's only three-ish feet or so. And that would be a little hard to see.
That's pretty negligible at the end of the day. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. But a much greater effect is wind. I mean, even small amounts of wind could have an enormous effect. And it could be that's sort of what you see. I don't know. I wasn't following the game last night, but small winds can make a 5 mile an hour wind is not a huge amount of wind, and that could have, if that's blowing out, that could be more than 15 feet on a fly ball. That's
oh,
huge.
Okay. Maybe that's what I was missing.
That it could sense. Be, and it's very, very hard to account for in a precise way to account for the wind. Because it's going, it's very conceivable it's going at different speeds and in different directions at different locations in the stadium, at different elevations in the stadium. You know, at ground level, it's different than it is once you're above the stands, above the roof. So it's very hard to account for that. But so it can produce very funny effects that are unexpected. But the effects could be quite large, and I think those kinds of effects are really certainly much larger than effects due to humidity, and you know, quite a bit larger than effects due to temperature, except at the extreme temperatures.
That's really, really interesting. Wow. I want to use part of your answer as a segue, because you mentioned exit velocities and launch angles in your answer a second ago. We're seeing this particularly. You know, exit velocity. We're seeing that a lot more in games and on, you know, broadcast now. I mean, you know, every time somebody hits a home run, it comes right up. My question to you is kind of, what is that information really telling us, and what is it maybe not telling us at the same time?
Well, exit velocity is a measure of how hard that ball is hit. And generally speaking, when you hit the ball, you're trying to hit it hard. I mean, you know, there are times when you maybe not, where you're just trying to get a bloop single or punch the ball through the infield. But generally speaking, the hard, you know, if you hit the ball hard, you will enhance your chances of getting on base. And so with StatCast, we have a measure of how fast that ball is leaving the bat, the so-called exit speed or exit velocity. And more and more broadcasters are sort of giving you that information over, you know, on radio or TV. And I think fans are developing a feel for what those numbers mean. And so to put that in perspective, as I said before, a typical home run is hit, I think the average home run exit speed last year and this year is 102, 103 miles an hour, something like that. So that, you know, that's sort of a benchmark. If someone hits the ball at 115 miles an hour, you know, people I think know, fans who are paying attention know that's hit very, very hard. I mean, the number of balls hit with an exit speed in excess of 115 miles an hour is really very, very small. And if someone hits it at 90 miles an hour, you know, that's the other extreme. That's not all that good. Okay. So exit speed for sure matters. And I think fans know, you know, you see a guy hits a ball hard, and now we have, before you could always say, okay, he hit that ball hard, he hit that ball weakly, this one was somewhere in between. Now we have a quantitative way to talk about it. I think fans are more and more are probably starting to appreciate that now that they're becoming educated as to how to place that into context. Exit speed's not the only thing that matters, though. The other thing that matters is the launch angle, the vertical launch angle. What was the initial direction vertically that the ball took off? And I don't know if the average fan has developed a good intuition about those numbers. But if you look at if you're trying to get a home run, you want that exit that launch angle to be, you know, sort of 25 to 30 is sort of optimum, but anywhere's between maybe 20 and 35 will more or less get you there. If you're down around 20, you probably have to hit the ball a bit harder to get a home run. Similarly, if you're up around 35, but the real sweet spot for that is 25 to 30 degrees. But if you hit the ball at 25 to 30 degrees, but don't hit it quite hard enough, say you only hit it at 90 miles an hour instead of 110 miles an hour, it's just going to be a lazy fly ball or a warning track shot. It's not going to make it. But then if you hit it really softly at that angle, like 70 miles an hour, 65 miles an hour, it's probably going to be a bloop single. So, you know, there's this thing that people sometimes call the donut hole. You know, you launch the ball at 25 degrees or so, you hit it real soft, you get a bloop single, hit it really hard, and you get a home run, and you hit it somewhere in between, and you fall into the donut hole. It's just going to be an easy out.
That's interesting. That makes a lot of sense, sure. So where does this data that we're collecting now and that you guys are collecting now, where does that take your research and where does this information take us 5 years from now?
Well, ever since we had the ability to collect data like this, and we've really had this ability even before the StatCast era. I mean, PitchFX, HitFX provided that data, not publicly, but the HitFX data to teams that subscribe to it. Ever since that first occurred, way back in roughly 2009, I and others have advocated that this is a really good way to evaluate hitting. Rather than evaluate hitting by the traditional way of asking what was the outcome, single, double, triple, home run, out, batting average, weighted on base average, slugging percentage, whatever your favorite metric is. Instead, one ought to develop metrics based on how well that ball was hit, independent of what that outcome is. So you see it all the time. A guy hits a rope, okay? Hard hit ball that, you know, well over 100 miles an hour at a 15 degree launch angle, which typically would get you a line drive single, maybe 10 to 15 degrees, and it just happened to be hit right at somebody. And he's out and he's got nothing to show for it. Well, seems to me that guy should be credited with having hit the ball well, despite the fact that he didn't get on base. Similarly, players hit the ball poorly and they get lucky. And they do get on base because, a seeing eye dribbler through the infield, for example. So I think that this is a way to evaluate hitting that, as I said, independent of outcome, depending only on how well that ball was hit, based on, you know, objective analysis of exit speed, launch angles.
That's interesting. And maybe the next generation is using it in scouting purposes at the lower levels to identify good hitters. Maybe that's where the benefit comes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where we're headed.
Wow, that just blew my mind again. That's great. That's very interesting. I don't know how to transition off that, but I want to transition, if I can, and just ask you kind of one more question. I know you've been announced as a Sabre Seminar presenter this year. If you could give us a little sneak preview, so to speak, of what the topics might be, I'd love to hear kind of what you're going to be talking about.
Yeah, I think the primary thing I'm going to talk about, and maybe the only thing I'll talk about, I haven't completely put it together yet, is work that I did over the last 6 months or so on optimizing the batter's swing in terms of how what the batter, the so-called swing plane, the direction that the bat is moving as it makes contact with the ball, as well as quantifying the notion of squaring up on the ball. What do you mean by squaring up on the ball? How do you quantify it? Even how do you measure it? And so I did. I wrote a couple of articles about that for the Hardball Times late last year, and my research into this has continued. I'm working on trying to look at StatCast data and draw some conclusions about what a batter's swing plane is. So, you know, one of the things about swing plane is that, you know, the ball, as it's being pitched, always crosses home plate on a downward trajectory. Okay. You know, the ball is released maybe 6 feet above home plate. So, and it's all, you know, if it falls in the strike zone, it's around maybe 3 feet or so above the ground. So it's always falling, mainly due to gravity. And so the question arises, what's the optimum way to swing at such a pitch? Do you want to swing up on it? Do you want to swing down on it? Do you want to swing level? Or do you want the trajectory of the bat to essentially fall, the upward trajectory of the bat to follow the downward trajectory of the ball? So there are different ways that one might try to optimize the swing, depending on whether you're trying to hit a home run or simply trying to get on base or simply trying to minimize timing errors. The optimization for how you do that is different depending on what your goal actually is. And so that's the work that I've been doing, and that's probably will be the main topic of my talk at the Sabre Seminar.
That sounds great. I can't wait. I'm really excited to hear your presentation, and certainly after this, it's got my mind racing with plenty of more questions. I'm looking forward to it. So, Alan, I'd love to give you a spot here for your plugs, where people can find your work online, your Twitter, anything and everything that you would like to plug.
Yeah, sure. So I have, as you mentioned earlier, a Physics of Baseball website that I try to keep fairly up to date with interesting articles and information. It's physics.illinois. It's baseball.physics.illinois.edu. And you could also follow me on Twitter at POBGUI, P-O-B-G-U-I. P-O-B stands for Physics of Baseball. At POBGUI, or send me an email, a-nathan@illinois.edu. I get lots of emails in the course of a week asking me various questions, and my one rule in life is I try to answer them all as best I can. So if people ask me questions, I try to answer them.
Well, that's fantastic. And I can tell you, you respond very quickly to emails. That's absolutely for sure. So,
yeah, my wife criticizes me for that. She says I always have my technology sitting on my lap all hours of the day. But all right, anyway.
It's funny. My wife says the exact same thing. So, Alan, just thank you so very much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Like I said, this was fantastic. I've got so much. I can't wait to re-listen to this and get my, you know, 100 more questions for you when I see you at Sabre Seminar. So thanks for coming on.
All right. And, yeah, looking forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing you and shaking your hand there.
All right, good.
And that was episode 73 of the Nats GM show with Dr. Alan Nathan from the University of Illinois and the website The Physics of Baseball. And a great follow on Twitter, too, at POB Guy, as you mentioned. He's a great follow as well. So look for him there and check out all of his work. Just a fantastic guy and incredibly smart work that he's doing at his site. So I want to thank him for coming on. That was a real treat for me. So the episode is a wrap. Number 73 is in the books. Bye for now.